You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 1st, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author and Nation magazine writer Ari Berman on the Supreme Court case regarding one person, one vote, and how the money primary is undermining voting rights, a fascinating theory that the enormous amount of money flooding in to our elections could actually run afoul of civil rights legislation that protects voting rights. Also on the program today, Denny Hastert. Apparently he's a victim too. Or at least that's what he told friends. As a second person comes out, I think when we left on Friday, it had not been established that in fact there was some molestation involved with a... Still don't know the age of the people when he'd committed this, but now there's a second person. And it would frankly be surprising if this wrestling coach just acted inappropriately with one kid. Also on the program today, last night, the Senate fails to reauthorize the USA Patriot Act. And as such, ladies and gentlemen, party like it's 1999, they're not hoovering up your phone calls. Although my guess is they probably are. But they supposedly have shut it down. It will. We will touch on what happened in the Senate last night. Also on the program, the founder of Silk Road gets life in prison. And as far as I can tell, it is for offenses that could have imprisoned him at a minimum of 20 years. But life imprisonment seems like there's something else going on here rather than allowing basically an open bazaar for illicit drugs. In terms of what the government was able to convict him on. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, the poor shaming never ends. Got a couple of stories to this effect, ranging from a new CBS show called The Briefcase, but also a story that came out of Queens. It's just unbelievable. I don't dig into stories like that, but it just shows the attitude that has permeated this country towards people living in poverty. It's stunning to me. And I should say, we're also, it is June, ladies and gentlemen. Over the next 6 weeks, we're going to see multiple, I don't know when it's going to start, probably in about 2 weeks. The Supreme Court is going to announce decisions in cases that they have heard and reviewed over the past year or 9 months. And of course, one of them is going to be King v. Burwell, this is going to heat up. It's going to be a big deal. It's going to be a big deal if they find. Remember the case King v. Burwell. I hope everyone knows this by now. Otherwise, I feel like I haven't done my job. But we have some recent listeners, so they may not realize that we've spent months on King v. Burwell. And this is a case, and as all these cases are, and I'm not maligning that. I think that's fine on some respect, in some respect. All these cases are brought by a couple of different conservative organizations. And when I mean all of these cases, I mean almost every single Voting Rights Act case that we will talk about is brought by the same conservative organization. They go out and they find plaintiffs, but they're the ones bringing this. In this case, in terms of King v. Burwell, same situation, but with an organization that has been bringing all of the Affordable Care Act cases. This case says that because in the law there is one sentence suggesting that subsidies not be paid to states that have not set up their own exchanges. And remember, that's 36 states. The federal government has set up exchanges for 36 states. That they would not be eligible, or rather their citizens who buy health insurance on these exchanges would not be eligible for subsidies, which is essentially the fulcrum of this part of the Affordable Care Act. Read in totality, which is what you're supposed to do with legislation, looking at the intent of the legislators, and there was that piece in the New York Times last week which exemplified that. The idea that states, the citizens of states who set up, who do not set up their own exchanges, but rather let the federal government do it, the idea that they would not receive subsidies from the IRS is ludicrous. Ludicrous. But the Supreme Court has shown certainly a willingness to entertain those things based upon their desire for a specific political outcome.
Entertain the ludicrous.
Indeed. And so if they rule that it's the case that these citizens are not eligible for subsidies, it is going to be a crap show, ladies and gentlemen. So we will update you on those and other cases. And before we take a break and talk to Ari Berman, just want to note that Beau Biden, I believe he was 46, the former attorney general for Delaware, I believe it was, right? Delaware. Son of Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, passed away, I guess it was Saturday, of he'd been in a long battle with brain cancer since 2013. Apparently had gone into remission and then came back over the past couple of months. Two things of note. I mean, generally I don't pay much attention to deaths of well-known people. I mean, but Joe Biden, I think everybody knows that story about right after he got elected into the Senate in his late 20s, I think he was. I think it was like 29, maybe 30.
Elected at 29, and I think you can't take a Senate until you're 30, I think.
So he was in Washington setting up his staff. He got a phone call. It was mid-December. His family had been in a car accident. His wife and his daughter died in the accident. His two sons, one of whom was Beau, in the hospital, it sounded like he almost didn't take his position as senator, but he insisted on being sworn in from their hospital rooms because he didn't want to leave them. You can see a picture of Beau when he was 4 looking at his father getting. So this is particularly sad for a parent to outlive two, at least, of his three children. And Beau Biden also, you know, to the extent that I was aware of what he did as a as an attorney general, he was very strong on the whole mortgage thing. One of the big holdouts for the national settlement. And then he stopped at one point. I don't know if it was in any way related to his illness. But also very good on, you know, things like child protection. So just wanted to mention that because it's a real shame. And finally, before we go and talk to Ari Berman, just a reminder about Credo Mobile. We only have a couple more weeks, I think, left for this deal. You've got to go do this now, folks. Credo Mobile, America's only progressive phone company. We spoke to Becky Bond last week. You got a sense of just how serious Credo Action is. Credo Mobile supports Credo Action. In addition to that, they also fund progressive nonprofits from Planned Parenthood to Democracy Now, the Sierra Club, the Union of Concerned Scientists. They've donated millions upon millions of dollars to those organizations. So it's a great company, and they're giving you a great deal. I've been noodling around. When I say $100 off any phone, you can get any phone and the $100 off of what they normally charge people for these phones with a two-year deal. You get 25% off your data plan fees. And if you're locked into another contract, they will pay any of your early termination fees, or they'll give you a credit, I should say, on your Credo bill, up to $350 per line. They'll also give you a trade-in for your existing phone. This is a great deal, folks. Head over to credomobile.com/majority report. See the offer. You can also call 800-966-1665. Use the offer code 501-882. If you have any questions, of course, about it, give us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll be right back after this with Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. It is always a pleasure to welcome this next guest to our program. He is a writer with The Nation magazine, author of the wildly successful Herding Donkeys, and also the author of the forthcoming book. What is your forthcoming book, Ari?
Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ari Berman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Ari, there's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. One is your piece in, I think it's going to be in the June Nation magazine, which is fascinating because everybody knows about the money primary. But what I didn't know about was sort of there's another way to look at this, and I want to get to that in a moment. But before we do, there is a case out there that the Supreme Court is now considering, Evanwell versus Abbott. tell us about this case and if this is going to have important implications on the right for people to vote in this country.
Yeah, so the case, as you mentioned, is about how you calculate the drawing of districts. In this case, it's a challenge to state Senate districts in Texas. And ever since the one-person, one-vote rulings of the 1960s, the theory has been that you calculate population for districts based on the total population. So you include everybody who's in that district to essentially calculate the total number of people and then decide representation that way. Now, the people that are challenging the state Senate districts in Texas, the same people who challenged the Voting Rights Act, I might add, they're saying, no, the way that you should calculate districts is only based on the eligible voters. So you shouldn't include children, you shouldn't include prisoners, you shouldn't include non-citizens. You should only include those people that are actually able to cast a ballot. And that's very significant because basically you're saying that only people who can vote or who are eligible to vote deserve representation. And that that will exclude a large segment of the population. So if the districts are drawn based only on eligible voters, what's going to happen is that districts that are drawn are going to be more rural, they're going to be more white, and they're going to be more conservative, because cities, by and large, are places where people who are, you know, children, prisoners, non-citizens, etc., are more likely to live in cities, more likely to live in urban areas, more likely to live in liberal districts. So this is just another way that representation in America would become more conservative, and certain people would not have any representation, whether or not they can or can't vote.
And so I think what's sort of surprising about this to people is that this hasn't been resolved already. I mean,
well, the reason, I mean, it's very surprising that the Supreme Court decided to take this case, because everyone thought this was resolved. I mean, there really wasn't much of an issue here. I mean, one person, one vote has been established principle since 1964. People have not really been debating this issue that much. And so for the court to take it, I mean, there's two theories about why they took it. One theory is that maybe the liberal justices agreed to take the case as a way to squash this issue once and for all, or potentially it's possible that the conservative justices agreed to take this case. Remember, it only takes three justices to hear a case, but anyway, that they decided to hear it essentially because this is going to be another decision that's going to radically shift voting rights to the right. I mean, you already had a situation where, you know, they gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, a very radical decision, and now they're talking about one person, one vote. If they were to decide that only eligible voters count for representation, that would be a dramatic that would essentially mean a dramatic redrawing of so many districts across the country. I mean, it would be a huge, huge deal.
I got to tell you, it seems unlikely to me. The three liberal justices said, like, oh, this is the country has just been buzzing about this, and it's wasting so much resources. Let's clear the decks with this. It sounds to me like, because, you know, people have to see this in the larger context, right? Of this is a Supreme Court that, at least in all intents and purposes, gutted one of the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so this wouldn't be unprecedented for the Roberts Court to do this. It's absolutely true. The flip side of that is it only takes a Thomas, a Scalia, and an Alito to hear the case. So, I mean, we just don't know. I mean, would Anthony Kennedy, who has positioned himself kind of on both sides of this issue, do something this radical? I mean, it's certainly possible he did vote to get the Voting Rights Act. At the same time, this seems to me that it's something that would be even more remarkable, because remember, in the Voting Rights Act case, there was a lot of conservative opposition to the Voting Rights Act. I argue that opposition was misplaced, but there was a long record here. In this case, Texas is arguing on the same side as the federal government. So, I mean, you have a situation where even Texas, which is one of the most rampant violators of the Voting Rights Act, they don't even want these districts to change. So really the only person that's challenging this is this guy, Ed Blum, who launched the case that challenged the Voting Rights Act and then essentially is trying to challenge these districts. He knows they're protected under the Voting Rights Act, but he's trying to challenge them kind of through their back door. And so this was something, somewhat of an innovative case that he brought. Everyone thought it was a long shot, so it was surprising that the court decided to hear it.
Is there going to be an oral argument to this case, or are we going to hear the is one of those cases that we just we're going to hear the answer sometime, I don't know, in a month or so?
No, I mean, I think there's going to be an oral argument.
And what about the practical implications of this? In other words, like, don't we use the size of a congressional district in terms of resources in certain instances? Isn't this also sort of like how we use the census? Like, I mean, there's going to be a lot of, it seems to me, there's a lot of practical implications to this, aside from the fact that we're going to have districts where there's no consciousness of anybody living there except for voters. I mean, it's a very weird. Before we get into the practicality, just talk about the concept of why one person, one vote, which we've never really questioned, is so important, right? I mean, because I could see some people saying, like, well, I mean, why should kids be counted in terms of, like, in a congressional district? They just live there.
Yeah, well, I mean, one person, one vote was so important because before you had that, you had districts that were wildly uneven. First off, you could have a district with 800,000 people in one district and 200,000 people in another. But basically what happened was that under one person, one vote, you had these large conservative rural areas that were disproportionately powerful, that they had way, way, way more power than anyone else because of uneven distribution of the drawing of districts. And so when every district was drawing the same, that normalized things. That meant that, you know, urban areas had as much, if not more influence, obviously more influence because they had more people than these conservative rural areas. And so a lot of people were denied representation because of the malapportionment that happened before one person, one vote. And so if you were then to get rid of that, then what you would essentially be doing is shifting power back to the people that essentially don't have or don't deserve as much representation because there's just not as many people. And the other thing is just this basic concept of who deserves representation, right? Just because you can't vote, does that mean that you don't have needs? You shouldn't be looked after? I mean, do children not count? Do non-citizens not count? Does a congressperson decide that I'm only going to look after the people that actually physically vote for me? I mean, in that case, that would dramatically narrow the whole concept of representation in this country and who deserves to be looked after.
Right. And we should make it clear, this isn't a situation of undocumented immigrants. This is just people who are legal residents also not counted as opposed to just citizens.
Absolutely.
All right. So from a practical standpoint, big implications in terms of the census and like apportioning resources?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big issue. I mean, there's already concern that the census is undercounting people. And then if you don't include the census, if you do it some other way, there's just going to be even more questions about the data we're using. I mean, no one believes that there's any real practical way to do this. So I think that this would be a very unworkable situation if the Supreme Court was going to decide it this way.
All right. Well, I guess we will find out the – we don't have to have too much suspense, right? Because we'll find out within 6 weeks, it seems to me. Is that usually how it works, right?
No, I mean, I think that the case is slated. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the case is slated for oral arguments. And so I think this is going to be a long process.
Oh, really? But isn't the term over in this? Aren't they considering it this term?
I don't know. I have to look back at it because this is too much detail, Sam. Okay?
I understand. I'm sorry, buddy.
Questions.
I know. I know. You're used to a little less detail on that.
Yeah, usually I can just slack through.
I know you've got other things to do other than to check the Supreme Court schedule. But be that as it may, one of those things that was you're writing this piece for The Nation magazine, and you outline – And this is pretty amazing because as I was reading your piece, I mean, I think this audience is fairly well informed about just how much money we're talking about and how much the sort of the gloves have come off after after both the McCutcheon case and the Citizens United case. But it's interesting to me because I was just thinking, you know, we've seen all these reports coming out of Iowa where Bernie Sanders is getting massive crowds for Iowa. I mean, massive crowds, like crowds that are larger than the towns he's showing up in. And huge, as he would say. Bigger than what Dean was getting, is my understanding at this time. And this is a guy who came out of nowhere. But there's still this sort of sense of like, well, that's great, but Bernie doesn't have the money that Hillary has, so it's completely written off. And that creates an interesting dynamic. Just set it up for us, because before we get to this part about how people are starting to theorize that this undermines voting rights.
Yeah, well, I mean, the money has just become so determinative at every stage of the political process. I mean, the money decides, not just on the presidential level, but on the congressional level and all the way down. I mean, the amount of money you can raise decides who gets to run. It decides who the media takes seriously, which is your point about Bernie Sanders. It decides which issues are prioritized. It decides 90% of the time who actually wins. And so at every stage of the process, there's what is known as this wealth primary. And the wealth primary is a factor at every stage of the process. So it's a factor in terms of who's running for office, who's being taken seriously, who is winning, and which issues are getting prioritized and which donors are getting prioritized. And this is just a phenomenon that's getting worse and worse and worse, and particularly in the wake of Citizens United, it's just exploded to the point where there's so much money in the system that there's really no checks to try to, you know, in any sort of feasible way, control the influence of it.
And we should say, obviously, this is Republican and Democrats. I mean, you outline, I would love to see someone make a graphic of the billionaires that support each one of the candidates, because I feel like there's a couple of people I don't know who are aligning or I don't know who's which billionaires are aligning with every one of those candidates. Now, to be, you know, to cut myself some slack, there's a lot of candidates out there now. But I mean, so you've outlined a tremendous amount of money, and we're looking at $1 billion, right, on both sides, a couple of $1 billion, right?
Oh, easily. I mean, we're looking at, I mean, the Koch brothers alone are going to spend almost $1 billion. The Clinton campaign is going to spend $1 billion. The Republican primary, I mean, you could get multiple $1 billion. I think everyone expects that this election is going to cost, like, $7 to $8 billion when it's all said and done.
That's just stunning. And we can't really know these days exactly what the numbers are, right? Because we're starting to see this development where the candidates are outsourcing a lot of their work to these super PACs. And these super PACs have a lot less disclosure requirements. And so they're going to be running sort of these parallel campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, they're already running parallel campaigns. I mean, Jeb Bush hasn't even announced for president, and yet he's going around raising money for his super PAC, and his super PAC is doing all the things a traditional candidacy would do. I mean, you have a situation where recently Foster Freeze, who was Rick Santorum's biggest donor in 2012, basically said, if I give the money, I'm going to give it secretly. So it's like, you're not even going to know if I gave it. And what a brazen thing to essentially say that, you know, and what he's doing is not illegal. So, I mean, there's really no penalties for what he's doing. I mean, he can basically say, I'm going to give all this money and you won't know about it. But yet somehow we feel that we're living in a democracy when this kind of stuff goes on, where a billionaire can give as much money he wants with no disclosure. And that's somehow compatible with a democratic system.
All right. So let's talk about this in the context of the Voting Rights Act, because there is an intersection here in these issues that I don't think is necessarily intuitive, or at least it wasn't until you started to tease it out in this. I mean, start to talk about like how that's the case, how the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act may intersect with this issue.
Sure. So, I mean, let me just lay out first the kind of broad argument, which is the broad argument is that, you know, when the wealthy have so much power in the political system, their vote matters more than everyone else. So that's the basic argument of the piece, that the wealth priming in American politics is undermining the value of the vote, not the right to vote, the value of the vote for basically everyone who's not a billionaire. Now, the second thing you look at is there.
Wait a second. I really want to walk through that. Why is that the case? Right. Everybody can still go walk into the ballot box and vote. So why is that the case?
Well, let's just look at the end game here. Everyone can vote, but first off, we already talked about the fact that, you know, you have to have money to run for office. You have to have money to win office. So already there's a narrowing down effect. But most importantly, what happens once someone's elected? Which issues are prioritized? And I think that's really where we see the wealth primary in action, because there's this huge disparity between the rich and everybody else when it comes to policy preferences. There's been research on this. For example, 68% of the public thinks that, you know, the government should make it sure that everyone who wants to work can find a job. So 68% of the public believe that, but only 19% of the wealthy agree. And there's been extensive research by these political scientists, Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, Gillens from Princeton and Page from Northwestern. And they've basically found that when the wealthy want a policy to happen, it becomes law. And when the public wants a policy to happen, it doesn't become law.
Unless the wealthy
also want it to happen. And that basically means that the wealthy determine virtually every policy that happens in American politics when it comes to the economy. Their exact words is, quote unquote, economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. In the United States, the majority, quote unquote, does not rule, at least in the casual sense of actually determining policy outcomes. That means that the public can vote for a candidate who supports raising the minimum wage. But if the wealthiest Americans aren't for the minimum wage, the likelihood of it becoming law is so much less than it otherwise would have been. And that's why I argue that the billionaires have such a greater value of their vote than everyone else does.
I mean, and we've had Gillens. People can search the site and find we interviewed Gillens on this. But I want to figure out, though, how we make this jump. And it seems to me like you quote free speech for people, I guess, which has been exploring whether the wealth primary violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits a voting system in which the totality of circumstances leads to minority voters having less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and elect candidates of their choice. So the totality of the circumstances, at the very least, broadens it out from just your ability to walk into the booth, right, and pull a lever, right? Because because it has to do with, like, what candidates are available, how easy it is for you to vote, whether or not your vote is as valuable as someone else's vote. In other words, if you're electing a congressperson and there's a smaller number of people in there, your vote is worth more. Then the question is whether they have less opportunity than other members of the electorate to participate in the political process and elect candidates of their choice. I guess the question is like, if the wealthy are part of the electorate, and they have more opportunity to participate in the political process and more opportunity to elect candidates of their choice, that seems to be the rub. Is that where we're talking about?
Well, in terms of the Voting Rights Act, the violation would essentially be, you know, if people of color are essentially disadvantaged in this wealth primary. And the facts are that they are. I mean, you look at, people of color are 37% of the U.S. population, but only 1% of campaign contributors and 10% of elected officials. And so you have a situation where they're at a serious marked disadvantage in the wealth primary. They control fewer resources, and they're further down the socioeconomic scale. And that's why, you know, I quote a study by George Washington University law professor Spencer Overton, where he says, a political process based on private money gives wealthier white communities disproportionately large influence in determining all candidates. And so then you look at Section 2 of the VRA, and Section 2 of the VRA has 9 factors that courts are supposed to consider when they're deciding if a voting system or a voting district is discriminatory. And 2 of them specifically relate to the wealth primary. One, whether the effects of past discrimination in things like education, employment, hinder their ability to participate in the political process, which courts have found has been the case. And also the exclusion of members, and this says, from the candidate slating process. Now, no one is officially excluded by the wealth primary, but certainly in terms of people not having access to money, not having access to donors, they are excluded. And it's true that people of color are more likely to be excluded because they have less money when they're running for office. And so this is not to say that this would be a slam dunk case. I mean, I think this would be a very, very tough case to win, particularly under the current judiciary.
Well, it's under the current judiciary, forget about it, right? I mean, when
the Roberts Court, the two things they hate the most are voting rights and the regulation of money in politics. So this would be like the ultimate twofer for John Roberts. He'd practically explode if this case reached the Supreme Court. But I wrote this to get people thinking about the issue, that maybe the amount of money in the political system, maybe it's not only morally wrong, maybe it's also legally wrong too. And we should start thinking about this. And we should start thinking about it in terms of all Americans, but we should also start thinking about it in terms of the Voting Rights Act, because that's an actual piece of legislation that you can litigate under, as opposed to the whole concept of getting money out of politics, which is basically totally legally unworkable right now with the current Supreme Court.
I mean, people should understand this. I mean, it's because there has been attempts to institute some type of campaign finance. That's been rolled back both sort of, I guess, not so much statutorily, but by the Supreme Court in its decisions. And we're talking about 5-10 years out, maybe, you know, about 5 years is not unrealistic, where we could be looking at a completely different Supreme Court. I mean, by completely different, I mean one where it's could very well be 5-4 in favor of more center left than center right, than, you know, from the center to the right. And, you know, because all it takes is you've got 2 Supreme Court justices on the conservative bloc who are in their at least deep into their 70s. Mid-70s, 2 of those people get replaced, and suddenly it's 5-3, or I should say 5-4. And so this is how this happens, right? These ideas. So, I mean, are there groups out there that are beginning to sort of think about this and develop this and starting to look for test cases? Because we should tell people that the first case we talk about, one person, one vote, is brought up by a think tank, essentially, couple of guys who go out and get money to bring cases like this, except for to disenfranchise people from voting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, 2 things will happen. Number one, if the Supreme Court changes, I think people will try to bring a challenge that gets the court to re-examine Citizens United. And so maybe that will be a more straightforward campaign finance case, because certainly 4 justices are very unhappy about Citizens United. And if there was a President Clinton was to name a second President Clinton was to name a Supreme Court justice. Hillary has already said that one of her litmus tests for a Supreme Court justice is whether they will look to overturn Citizens United. So that's already an issue that, despite all the money that she's raising, that she's identified as something that she cares about. And so I think whoever she appointed would would certainly want to relook at that decision. The second thing is trying to restore protections for voting rights, because as we mentioned earlier, the Voting Rights Act was gutted. And so I certainly think you're going to try to get cases up there that it gets the court to look at, in the absence of a congressional solution, more protections for voting rights. And this could be an issue potentially where there could be overlap between the campaign finance world and the voting rights world. And it would be an innovative case. It would be something that I think would not be the traditional case the court would heard, but the conservatives have been bringing crazy cases for years and trying to get the court to hear them, and they've succeeded by doing that. And this is just an attempt to try to get progressives to start thinking the same way, out of the box, a little bit more creatively about how to restore protections to a system that has gone completely out of control.
You mentioned in your piece Lawrence Lessig drawing parallels between the fight for voting rights in 1960 and the push to get money out of politics today. How much is he doing in terms of sort of trying to develop these theories? Because, you know, people should know, like, the for a lot of people, this is sort of the not so much the silver bullet, but this is the first thing that we have to fight and to figure out. And it's very difficult because it seems like just about all roads are barred in some respect, A. And B, it also seems like the public at large is not energized by this issue.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Lessig hasn't been looking so much at the litigation, even though he is a law professor. I think he's been looking more at what you just mentioned. Number one is mobilizing public opinion to get people to really care about the issue. And number two, I think he's trying to push for legislative solutions. And so one of the things he did in the last election was try to elect candidates who were more amenable to getting money out of politics. Now, that effort largely failed in 2014 because there was such a conservative wave election. But going forward, I mean, I think number one, he's gonna try to elect more progressive candidates on this issue, and then I also think there's a number of good pieces of legislation that would, you know, incentivize small donors. So it wouldn't ban rich donors, but it would just basically through public matching funds and other means give
right.
Small donors more of a value for their vote, because right now there's no real reason for a candidate to try to get a $5 donation if they can get a $5 million donation. I mean, why would you? But if you get a $5 donation and that's matched so that you get a bunch more $5 donations and there's actually an incentive to do so, then maybe candidates, not on the presidential level so much, but certainly for Congress and other races, would actually decide to look at smaller donor donations. And actually, if you look at, for example, de Blasio in New York, he was elected in large part because he was able to run because of a public matching system. And so that allows more progressive candidates to get elected. And so that's something that's being looked at in Congress. But, I mean, right now, any sort of congressional solution is really a Band-Aid on a completely broken system.
Wow. All right. Well, so, Ari, are you going to be, before you go, are you going to head on the campaign trail this year or no?
We'll see. I have a book to promote starting in August, so I'll be on my own campaign trail then, and then probably eventually I'll be on the actual campaign trail at some point.
What do you make out of, I mean, I should just to give people some backstory. Ari still owes me, as far as I can tell, hundreds of dollars worth of dinners from ranging back from like 2007.
One dinner, okay, one dinner.
Well, but I think it was worth like hundreds of dollars. Because
it was worth like $200, and I think you waived the fee eventually.
I may have waived the fee. Just
there
because,
may have been a statute of limitations on that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as a
but not in you talking about it, because certainly in like 35 years, you're still going to be like we're going to be like sitting around playing bingo, and you're still going to be talking about like the money that you won for me in 2008.
There are times just over the course of the day where I just yell bingo and say, and people say, "What are you talking about?" And I go, "Well, I beat Ari in that bet. I had that bet with Ari in 2007." When we bet as before, I think President Obama was even the nominee. I think I got the I bet the percentage he was going to beat the Republican by.
So which horse are you riding today?
Which horse am I riding today? Well, I think the Democrat is going to beat the Republican, I would say, and I think it's going to be probably anywhere from 3 to 4 percentage points.
Mm-hmm. And who are you predicting for the Republicans?
That's tricky, but I tend to go. I'm tending to lean towards Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it's conceivable. Bush or Rubio, but I tend to think it's going to be Scott Walker.
I don't think my one prediction is I don't think we're going to get a Clinton Bush election.
Wow. So are you saying possibly Bush Sanders?
Yes, I'm saying Bush Sanders. How'd you know?
I don't think Jeb Bush is going to make the long haul either.
No. I definitely don't think he's going to make the long haul. I think Walker or Rubio are the most likely to.
Yeah. Well, we're in agreement, so I guess I will not be.
We're going to have something to bet on sooner or later, though.
Yeah, exactly. But it sounds like we're going to have to go to a kid-friendly place now.
We can bet over popsicles at Kidville.
All right. We'll work on that. Ari Berman, always a pleasure. We will link to your piece, How the Money Primary is Undermining Voting Rights, at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Good to talk to you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to head to the fun half of the program today, where we will spend a lot of time complaining about the fact that we couldn't get our printer to work today.
Hook them in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the long reel.
Also, the temperature in this room is not ideal. And I think we're going to address that.
I thought
in the
it
fun
was
half as well. Well, maybe there's disagreement. Look at that, hijinks ensue.
Yeah, exactly. This is going to be a fun one, folks. I barely had time to print out my my news, but we have some sound for you. We will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. Also, folks, the app, it's totally free. You can pick it up at majorityapp.com. You can search the archives. If you're a member, you can search all, what are we at now, 1,500 shows? I have no idea. I literally have no idea. And I think the last 50, if you're a freebie listener, it's your membership, incidentally, that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. We can't do it without you. As a bonus, we give you, as a way of saying thank you, essentially, we give you an extra 40, 50 minutes, sometimes hour and a half day. Hour and a half a day. So please, if you can afford to support the program, please do so today. Also, don't forget the Credo deal, fantastic deal, credomobile.com/majority report is the address. You can always find that at our sponsor page. CredoMobile.com/majority report. Get that great Credo deal. They're sponsoring us all this month. Head over there. Thank them for sponsoring us. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Get the Majority Report blend. Turn your other people on to it, your friends. And, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, you can, of course, also IM me at Majority FM or via the app. We'll be right back.